Hey everyone, I'm Chris Hall, and this is the Downtime Podcast, where we take you inside the world of mountain biking. Meet the characters involved, hear their stories, and find some insight to help us all get faster on our bikes. Before we hear from this week's guest, I just want to say thanks to my supporting partners and mention the offers that they have for you. First up, thanks to 661, our first ever partner, and they're back to support a couple more episodes. They've just launched their Reset MIPS full face helmet. They've been working closely with MIPS to be one of the first brands to feature the brand new E2 system. It's specifically designed for full face helmets, and it helps to keep you safer and reduce the rotational forces transmitted to your head in a crash. If you've listened to our concussion special episode from last year, then you'll know why a good helmet is an essential thing. The Reset MIPS comes in a couple of really nice colorways, and having had the chance to ride in one recently, I've been really impressed at how comfortable and how light they've been able to make it. It looks and feels like an expensive helmet, but they've somehow managed to make it a bargain at only £115. It's the perfect full face for anyone who needs to be safe on uplift days or the odd big mountain strip, but doesn't use a full face often enough to justify spending a whole heap of cash. What's more, if you're a Downtime listener, then you get 25% off that and the rest of the 661 range. Just head to 661.com and use the code DOWNTIMEPODCAST25. That's DOWNTIMEPODCAST and then the number 25, and it's all lowercase. Also, a massive thanks to the Trailhead Bicycle Company. The Trailhead is an awesome bike shop in Shrewsbury, right here in the UK, which is run by Sandy Plenty, who was a guest on the podcast last year. Sandy passionately believes in the value that local bike shops add to the local riding community, and I totally agree with him. No one expects you to make all your purchases there, but they are important, and they offer support and knowledge that's hard, if not impossible, to find online. So please try and support your local bike shops. If you're in Shropshire, then don't forget to drop in and check out the Trailhead. It's a great shop with awesome staff and some amazing products in stock. You won't regret it. If you do go to the Trailhead, then mention that you heard this message on the podcast, and the staff there will sort you out with a Trailhead top cap or a fender free of charge. You can find out more about the Trailhead at thetrailhead.co.uk, and you can find them on Instagram at the_trailhead_bicycle_co, or you can follow Sandy over on Instagram. He's at sandy_plenty. Just a quick reminder that if you want to support the podcast and help it keep going, then you can grab yourself something from our web store at downtimepodcast.com/shop. We've got t-shirts and mugs, and then hoodies and sweats are now available again too. If you want any of the links that I've mentioned in the episode, they'll be in the show notes. Just head over to downtimepodcast.com. Right, it's time for this week's guest. Today, we're going to be joined by Ben Arnott, the mechanic for the YT Mob. He's worked for many riders over the years, including Greg Williamson, Laurie Greenland, Nico Mullally, and this year for Angel Suarez. He's also an engineer who works at Cro-Mag Bikes in Whistler. We chat about how he got into the World Cup scene, working with the legendary Monk Dog, his thoughts on suspension setup and tyre pressure, and much, much more. So, without further ado, here's Ben Arnott. Ben Arnott, welcome to the Downtime Podcast. How's it going?
Pretty good. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Really good. Thanks. Good stuff. Well, let's start from the start then. Tell us all a little bit about how you got into riding in the first place.
Well, I grew up in a cycling family. My dad was a big cyclist all his life, or is a big cyclist. And he used to race a lot when he was younger. So I think from an early age, he wanted to get my brother and I on bikes. And we also grew up in Peebles in the Scottish Borders, which is kind of one of the main spots for mountain biking in Scotland. And so it just kind of happened naturally. Like, a lot of my friends at school rode bikes, and so it's what we did every weekend. And back in those days, there was no single track at Glentress Forest, so you had to get a lift right up to the top of the hill, which is what we did, and then you just rode back down the road, which we thought was amazing at the time, which is kind of laughable now, but it was great at the time, such a good thing to do. And I guess I just started racing cross-country when I was probably, 10 or 11, and kept doing that all the way up until I went to uni. So, yeah, that was kind of the start for me.
Nice. Was there much of a scene up in the Tweed Valley at that point? Because it's obviously huge now. There's a lot of very fast riders from that neck of the woods, but were there many people out and about riding there?
Not really, not mountain biking. There's always been a lot of road biking around there, and that area of Scotland, there's a lot of amazing road cycling. So some of the road cyclists would mountain bike a little bit on the side. But at that point at Glen Tres Forest, which is now, there's a huge shop and cafe and everything there. There was one porter cabin, and it was a friend of my dad's actually had a little bike rental business there. I think he had something like 12 bikes, and he'd be lucky to rent all of those on an average sort of Saturday. So there wasn't really much of a scene, no.
Wow. Yeah, it's changed a bit to what there is today. Yeah. And how far did you go with the racing side of things? And did it get quite serious, or was it kind of a hobby for you?
I used to race in sort of Scottish level races, and then did some British level races as well, which were, I can't remember what they were called, MPS at the time or something.
Yeah.
And as a junior, I had some good sort of, I used to race a bit of time trialing on the road, had some decent results. And but I always had a really good attitude from my family that they were kind of like, if you want to do this, keep doing it and don't feel any pressure. And, you know, maybe if I'd had a tiny bit more pressure, I would have pursued it a little bit further. But I just quickly realized that the kind of racing cross country anyway sort of lifestyle wasn't for me. So I didn't really pursue it any further. And then I went to university and everything stopped for a while.
Fair enough. You studied engineering, yeah?
Yeah, I studied mechanical engineering.
Cool. And was that, you know, was there a drive at that point to kind of find your way into an engineering career, or was it just an interest that, you know, you wanted to follow up on? What made you go that path?
It was really just kind of, I was looking for something to do almost, because we're really, really lucky in Scotland that we get our first degree is paid for by the government, which is pretty unique and pretty amazing. So quite a lot of people go to university. It's a really common thing to do, and you don't have to come from a really wealthy background to do it. Mm-hmm. And so I got towards the end of school, and I was just working in a bike shop, kind of enjoying life and considered what I could do. And I had an interest in engineering and cars and working on bikes, and it just seemed like the most fitting sort of vocation that I could follow. Even though at that point I didn't have a kind of real exact idea of where I wanted to go.
Yeah. And were you, when you were working in the bike shop at this point, were you on the mechanic side of things or kind of just general staff in the shop?
Yeah, I was working as a mechanic. So my dad kind of taught me everything that I knew up to that point about fixing bikes. And I can't remember what happened, but I think when I was about 13, I wanted this set of wheels, and they were just like a set of wheels for my dirt jump bike. But at that point, I think it was going to cost £60 or something to get them built, which was a massive sum of money to a 13-year-old.
Yeah.
So I went into the local bike shop and asked if I could maybe get these wheels built, but I didn't have any money to pay for them. And there was a really great guy in there, Grant, who said, well, you can come and do some shifts if you like to pay off. And it kind of went from there, basically.
Nice. And did he teach you to build your own wheels?
Yeah, he did. So he sat me down with those wheels and sort of showed me what to do, which was awesome. And from then on, it just clicked with me, and I just really enjoyed the starting with the sort of pile of parts and ending up with a finished product.
Yeah, very cool. So how did you get from workshop mechanic in a local bike shop to a mechanic on a World Cup team? Talk us through the journey a bit.
Yeah, well, when I was at university, we got every summer off, and it was about 2 or 3 months we'd get. It was quite a long time, and it covered a good section of the World Cup season. So I already had it in my mind that it would be amazing to work for a team as a mechanic. It seemed like a sort of dream job and like the pinnacle of where I could get to as a bike mechanic. And I used to go up to Fort William every year and kind of walk around the pits and just stare at these guys wide-eyed. Which is funny now, because a lot of them are probably the same guys.
we
have a different relationship now, but it's still really good. But so I applied, actually. I used to on the UCI website, they list all of the teams. And every year I used to go through, they also have an email address. I used to just email everyone and send my CV and a little covering letter saying, I'd really love to come work for you. And most of them, I hardly got any replies, and I got sort of maybe a handful. And funnily enough, one of the ones that replied was Martin Whiteley. And this was years before I actually started working for him. But he said, you know, I thought it was really cool of him to reply. He said, we don't have any openings just now, but I'll definitely keep your CV on file, which is cool. And then I finished uni and I came to Whistler with a bunch of friends that I studied with for 4 months. And we did a sort of bike season here, and I worked in a bike shop in town, and it was a totally different type of bike shop job. We were doing a lot more suspension stuff and more downhill, like bike park stuff, basically. And I absolutely loved it, and it just strengthened the feeling that I wanted to do this. But then as I was there as well, I was thinking, man, I just graduated from university. And when you do that, you kind of have to get into the industry pretty quickly, into the engineering industry, because if you don't, you could definitely end up 3 years out of uni and nobody would take you for a job, because you've kind of, you know, you just missed the boat almost. So
yeah,
I started to feel that pressure. And while I was in Canada, I was loving it, but I was kind of like, oh, I should just go home and like do it for a little bit, just get some experience. And then I can do 2 years and I can leave and do a job that I want to do for fun and then maybe go back to engineering or whatever. And so I applied for a bunch of graduate schemes and I ended up getting one back in Edinburgh. And I went back and I started that, and it was, I don't know, everything that I didn't want to be doing as a job. It was in an office, you know, staring at a computer all day and not doing anything that I was particularly interested in.
Right.
And also it was a defense company at home, and it used to be owned by British Aerospace, BAE. And
okay, yeah,
that was a government run business for a long time, which meant that a lot of the guys that had been there, and some people had been there for 40 or 50 years, working since they were apprentices, they were so stuck in their ways that it was just a really kind of not a great environment to work in. And so
pretty demoralizing, I guess.
Yeah, pretty much. And so I would just sit there looking at my computer and thinking, I'm sure I could be doing something better than this, you know, like I'm pretty young and I could stay here, I'm sure, and then 10 years I'd be earning like a really good wage and it would all be good on paper. But I just had this feeling that I couldn't let myself do that. It was kind of overwhelming, and it meant also that I couldn't really do that work very well. I wasn't very focused on it, and I wasn't doing the best at that job, and that kind of made me think, you know, I'm kind of wasting my own time and everyone else's time here. So I figured I'd do it for 2 years, because that was the length of the graduate scheme. And actually, looking back, I learned so much from working at that company, good and bad things. Like, you know, I learned a lot about engineering and how it works to be in a big company, but it also gave me really good, strict boundaries of where I do and don't want to work. So it was kind of like, yeah, made it obvious to me, if I got into a job like that again, it would be really easy to say, like, hang on, I've been here before, I'm going to get out of this really quickly. So it was definitely a good thing overall. But so, yeah, when I got towards the end of the 2 years of that, I started applying again for these teams. And what I found is that my plan was just to stay at this engineering company until I got one of these jobs, which was my plan.
Yeah.
But what I found is that a couple of teams got back to me and said, yeah, sure, we'd like to sort of give you a trial. Can you come to, you know, Spain for 4 days in next weekend? And I just couldn't, because I'd have work and I wouldn't be able to get the leave in time and all this sort of thing. And World Cup teams, not all of them, but some of them are probably pretty unorganized. So it's, you know, they weren't planning things months in ahead.
Yeah.
So I realized that working at that place, I couldn't be sort of agile enough to to be able to do one of these interviews and pursue it. So I realized I just had to leave without having a job to go to, which was kind of scary. And I think my dad wasn't best pleased. But yeah, I did it. So I just left and I picked up part-time work at another bike shop in Edinburgh. And as luck would have it, a couple of weeks after that, a good friend of mine, Greg Williamson, gave me a call and said he was through, like, over the moon. He just got a job with or a ride with Track World Racing. And he said, I think Martin's looking for another mechanic, because it was around the time that Gwyn had left Trek. And so the team had had a big shakeup and some staff had left and there was a bunch of new riders. So basically Martin needed another mechanic. So I emailed him straight away and said, hey, I've sent you a CV in the past, but I know Greg's going to be riding for you and I'd love the opportunity to sort of trial as a mechanic. And it was funny because Greg got in trouble straight away because he wasn't meant to have said anything to anybody. And Martin was going to contact me in his own time. So, yeah, that was the first kind of experience that I had. But in the end, Martin called me and said I can't explain how excited I was when I heard from him. I was just like, this is maybe going to happen. It's crazy. And yeah, he said, we want to have you on for a trial. And so I was going to go to Belgium to Sander, who was the head mechanic at the Times House, do a 3-day trial, build all the European bikes with Sander. And if that went well, during that week, Sander was going to appraise me to Martin. And then if that went well, I was going to fly to California for the US bike build and team camp. And I was just like, wow.
Well, yeah, things move pretty fast.
Yeah. So yeah, that's how I got the first kind of opportunity to be on a team.
Yeah. So what was it like when you stepped in to the first World Cup race, kind of your first live situation as a mechanic? How did it feel?
Yeah, it was really, really nerve-wracking. Because before this, so that was 2013. I believe the first round was Fort William, which was double nerve-wracking because a lot of my friends go up to that race and I think my mom and dad came up. So I knew there was going to be a lot of people there. And to be totally honest, I didn't really know what I was doing. Like, I knew what to do regarding fixing bikes, but in terms of how to be a mechanic at a World Cup race, I didn't know what to do. So I'd had a lot of advice and help from the other guys on the team. But that first race, it was funny because it didn't go very smoothly, and if I did this now, I'd be really ashamed of myself. But we went to the top of the track, Greg Williamson and I, for his race run, and he'd qualified pretty well. And this was his first year in a big team, so he had a lot to prove, you know, a lot of pressure on him, especially at home. And we got to the top on the race day, and we were warming up. And at Fort William, the little warm-up area is down a bit of a hill to the start hut. And my friends were up there. So as Greg had jumped off the trainer bike and was riding around on his downhill bike, just doing little warm-ups, my friends were over and they were chatting to me and we're all just chatting away, having a time. And the next thing I can hear is just, Ben, Ben. And I look up the hill and it's Ben Cathro. And he's screaming my name and he's like, Greg's run. And I was just looked at my watch and I was like, no, we had like, I don't know, I think it was a minute to go. So whoa. I ran, sprinted up the hill and he's like raced up the hill on his bike and we got into the start hut and the guy in front of him had gone. So we must've had under 30 seconds at this point. And Greg's like, gloves, where are my gloves? And I'm like, oh man, I don't know. You need to go. And he'd left his gloves in the warm-up hut or whatever. And so he, like, raced out the start gate. And I was just standing there like, well, I was like, that was a nice experience, I guess, these last couple of weeks. But that's me never doing this again. I guess I've just lost my job because Greg never rides without gloves. And he's just gone for his first race run on this team without gloves. But anyway, he came down, and I can't remember his result, but it was like his best result, and it was either a top 10 or 11th or 2nd or 12th or something. So it worked out well in the end, but that was my baptism of fire.
I guess he had no time to get stressed if he didn't know his race run was about to start, so maybe that helped.
Absolutely, and it's something we've talked about a lot on the team. You know, like we, before a race run, you spend a lot of time up top, and every rider's got different rituals and stuff. And, you know, with Greg, the time I worked with him, we always tried to kind of keep it as short as possible and never let him kind of sit there and think about stuff and, you know, just try and get to the start gate. And then he had like a minute to go and he would just go, because that, it worked pretty well that time, even though it was a total mistake on my part. So
awesome. Good stuff came of it then. Happy days.
Yeah, so that's how you learn, I suppose.
Yeah, and you were working with Monk Dog at the time on Trek, is that right?
Yeah.
How was it working with him? I hear he's a bit of a legend.
Yeah, so I knew really well who he was when I was kind of an aspiring World Cup mechanic, and because he was just this absolutely unique person that, you know, just pictures of him, he looked like nobody else, and he had this amazing reputation. He'd worked with like the best riders. And that was when Martin called me and told me about the team and said, you're going to be going out to California to Monk Dog's house and you're going to build the US bikes. I was like, it can't be real. Like this, you know, it's, if you're into World Cup mechanics, this is like the coolest guy, like the OG kind of mechanic. So yeah. When I passed the trial in Belgium, I then flew to California, flew to, I think, to Denver, and then Denver to Ontario, which is a small airport near where Monk Dog lived. And I was so excited, and I think I arrived at about 11 p.m. My bags didn't turn up as normal, and I'm waiting in the airport, and Monk Dog's not there. And I was like, oh, that's kind of weird, because Sander, the European guy, was there early and like met me and was super accommodating and everything. And anyway, Monk was nowhere to be seen, and I just wasn't prepared. I didn't have his number or a way to contact him. So I eventually figured that out and called him on a payphone, and he was like, oh yeah, I'll be there. And I'm like, okay, like when? And he's like, oh no, I'll be there. Like, all right. So I'm sitting outside this airport, like tiny little airport with nobody there, on my suitcase kind of thinking, or my backpack thinking, what's going on? Like, is he going to turn up? And eventually this big diesel dually truck turns up, and I just knew instantly it was Monk, and like opened the passenger door, and like Mountain Dew wrappers and, or like McDonald's wrappers and Mountain Dew cartons like fell out, and I had to clear a space for myself to sit. And he was just like from day one, like cool as a cucumber. And that sort of week or 10 days I spent with him was just mad, like nothing I'd ever experienced before. Because I was in the desert in California where he lived, and which was kind of crazy in itself. And we just get up in the morning, cruise to like a fast food joint breakfast, go down to the Trek office and build some bikes, and then go to a restaurant at night and just hang out. And he would just tell me stories, and that was brilliant. And working with him was just incredible, like an absolutely amazing person with so many stories and quirks.
Yeah, what was the biggest thing that you kind of took away from working with Monk Dog then?
Well, I guess one thing would be just his passion and like love for the sport. That was his, and for mechanicking and being on it as a mechanic, you know, that was the most important thing to him. And yeah, he was, you know, I guess he was like institutionalized by being a World Cup mechanic. That was his thing. It was his like calling. He'd done it for so long. So when you'd see him at a race, he just looked right when he was in his corner of the tent with his like ridiculous toolbox, which was just, and just funny because John Hall and I said the same thing, because I think Monk kind of mentored John a little bit as well when John first came onto the circuit. And so, you know, obviously I think as we're going to talk about, toolboxes are like a big topic for World Cup mechanics. And Monk Dog had this one, which was like, I think it was 70 pounds. or maybe it was more at 80 pounds. So it was so heavy. And we'd be like, Monk, how do you even get that on the plane? And they'd be like, they know me. We're like, what? Like every airline? He's like, yep, they know me. I'm like, they probably did. But anyway, he had this toolbox which had like the biggest array of tools, but then also rubbish in it. Like, I mean, it was rubbish is a bit nasty, but just stuff that you never would ever need. Like, he had this set of called the mud rotors, which were brake rotors that had no holes in them or anything. And they were so old that they were like 140 millimeters or something. Like, they must have been from the late 90s. And they were like deep in the bottom of his toolbox. And he's like, yep, you know, never know when you might need them. I'm like, they wouldn't even fit anything that we use. And he's like, you never know.
Excellent. Proper character.
Just to be like, okay, sure. Yeah, it's brilliant.
Amazing. Cool. So go on then. Yeah, toolboxes. Your toolbox is pretty special. I found a little vid online when I was researching this episode. It's obviously a big thing amongst the mechanics, I guess. But I guess, you know, it is literally the tools of your trade. So they're super important to you, I guess.
Yeah, and the toolboxes, as fancy as they are, they're kind of relatively inexpensive considering that it's the only thing that we need to do our job, really, like to own ourselves. So, you know, I think if you added up my toolbox, like the work that's gone into it and the tools and the box and everything, it'd probably be like, I don't know, £2,000 or something like that. So it's not crazy, but the longer you stay on the circuit, the more you sort of think about how you could refine it. And, you know, you don't want to like take anything that you don't need to and all of that sort of thing. So I started off with the Park one, which is you can just buy and it comes with a whole set of tools. And it's kind of like a lot of people in my situation, when I bought that, do that. They buy that one because it's got everything in it. But you can instantly take out like 60% of it because it's got like, I don't know, bottom bracket tools for old Italian road bikes that you're never, ever going to use. So
yeah.
So I got rid of that one pretty quickly and just kind of kept building on this like custom box idea. And then John got his Pelly case and he got this Kaizen foam, which you can cut around your tools or whatever and sort of make them fit in there nicely. And it was awesome. And at the time it was like nobody else had, well, I guess a couple of people had kind of done that sort of thing, but John had really executed it really nicely. And, so I started kind of thinking about it and how I could, you know, like improve on that because we don't admit it, but it's a big competition.
Of course.
We're all involved in the World Cup because we're usually competitive people. So we can't race bikes. So we kind of try and like race our toolboxes. But yeah, so at the engineering company that I worked at, we, in the assembly rooms, it was all, had to be really strict for foreign object debris and ensuring that there was nothing in there that wasn't meant to be there. So for the toolboxes, we used to build a toolkit for whatever product we were working on and then go to this company that would make foam cutouts so that everything had a place and everything was in its place. Yeah. And so I just kind of thought, man, there must be places that do that here. And after a bit of research, I found a guy in Vancouver who is a helicopter mechanic, and in his spare time he has a machine, a router for cutting this foam. And so I just kind of started chatting to him, and I guess we kind of got on pretty well and realized that we were both kind of weird and really into this stuff. And so I actually went down to his place, and he had this big garage with like half jet engines in it from helicopters, and it was so cool. I was like, wow, this is gonna work. And we got in there and yeah, we spent a day just like laying my tools out, and he had some pretty cool software where you could like take a picture of it and then convert that to a CAD file. And what you would do, you'd cut the cutouts first out of cardboard and then check the fit of the tools, because nice. I had started doing the CAD model for the tools based off like measurements that I'd taken from them and some pictures and things, but kind of realized as I know how this is going to go, I'm going to send him the model, he's going to cut it, and then I'm going to sit the tools in and they're not going to fit well. which would just not work. So he does it out of cardboard, and then he can adjust the sort of sizing of it so that it fits really well. So yeah, like we spent a day doing that, and then I left him to it, and he shipped it back up to me in Whistler, and it arrived, I don't know, a week later. And yeah, it was like the best Christmas ever.
You've even got a YT Mob logo in the top of the foam, yeah?
Yeah. So there's like anywhere that there was space, he's like, you can put whatever sort of logo you want or anything. So I figured, yeah, I'd get the YT Mob one. And that toolbox as well, like funnily enough, it's really only works for that YT2S bike. if it was a different bike that I was working on and it required a 10 millimeter Allen key, for example, I would be useless. that makes it more ridiculous, really. And I'll probably have to modify it, you know, as every year goes on and the bikes that I'm working on have slightly different fittings or whatever.
Yeah, if bits change over the years, I suppose.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you've got a little tablet in the lid of the box.
Yeah. So in the lid, my idea was to have, there's actually foam in there that, because the lid's probably like, I don't know, 30 millimeters deep. And so there's foam in there with pockets in it. And the plan was to have like put zip ties and like little knickknacks in there. And then I got a sheet of carbon from Amazon, just like a sort of pre-cured sheet of 3 millimeter thick woven carbon. And the plan was to basically make like a door out of that for the lid. So I bought some magnets that would clip it at the top, and then at the bottom I was going to put like a piano hinge. And so I got there's a machine shop in Whistler called North Shore Billet, and I actually worked there for a little bit a couple of years ago, and one of the owners, Pete, was really interested in this project, and I asked him if he'd be able to machine this bit of carbon, if he thought, you know, it'd be all right with the tools that he had and everything, if he could machine it to fit in the lid. And I wanted to machine this pocket for a tablet in it, and he was super keen to do it. So I made a model for him, and he was in there late one evening machining this bit of carbon for me. So that was awesome that he did that. And then it's got a tablet that sits in the center of the lid, and it's on a magnetic mount, so I can take it in and out. But basically now I do all my settings on that. So I used to have a little notebook and write them down. So after the rider comes down, after every run, you'll just write, you know, what changes they make, like tire pressure and suspension settings, so on. And I would write it down on paper, and then I was going home in the evenings and putting it onto a spreadsheet, just so I had a like proper record of it. So I figured I would just cut out the middleman and do it on this tablet. And it's worked out really, really well, because now I've got all of the riders that I've worked with that toolbox's settings on there, and it's saved on the cloud. So like, if Nico wants to go and look at the settings today at home, he can just go onto the document and have a look at them.
Nice. That's really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. How often do you find that you go back to previous races in that document? Like, is it something you use quite often?
I thought we would use it more from year to year. Like, you know, I thought I'd look at Leogang settings from last year when we turned up at Leogang. But the problem is that most of the time the products have moved on too much for that. So like, for example, you know, the Fox will have a new damper in the fork, so none of the settings are relevant. You can't just transfer them over, but it definitely helps to have that data just to look back on. And you can, what I find really interesting about it, more so than where to start with like a base setting, is how the settings progress over the days.
Okay.
So you'll have like first practice day, and you'll usually see some pretty big changes after the first run of the first practice day. But then as the weekend goes on, the settings change quite a lot, and they trend the same way usually. So it's interesting to look at how the settings have increased, and you can kind of draw certain things from that. For example, tire pressure normally unless it gets really wet or the conditions change for the worse, tire pressure normally goes up throughout a weekend, because as they start going faster, they start hitting their rims more and hearing it and coming down and saying, yeah, can you just go like one or two more PSI, because I don't want to do that. Mm-hmm. So I think with Nico, I started looking at the data and seeing that we were doing that pretty consistently at every race. And from that, we kind of chatted about it and decided usually to run a little bit more on race run, actually. So before the race run, go like one or two more in each tire, just because as your speed's increasing, you're hearing that noise more. In your race run, you're going to be going theoretically the fastest you've gone all weekend, and you're going to be riding more aggressively, and you're going to be fatigued. So yeah, that's the kind of thing we use the data for.
Okay, so it's more like looking at trends and understanding kind of what you're doing with the bike rather than what you did last year with the bike, for example.
Yeah, and a lot of it, I think, as well, is like rider confidence. It's nice for Nico to be able to ask me, hey, what did I run last year for a tire when it was dry in Leogang? Or not Leogang, because that's a bad example, but some, you know, Val d'Isol, you know, what tires did I run last year? And you can say, and then that allows them to make a more informed decision about what they're going to do this race.
Yeah, cool. So you've worked with a few different riders over the years then. So Greg Williamson, Laurie Greenland, Nico, obviously. How long does it take to suss out like how to work with different riders, or is everyone kind of the same? Like, how much does it vary, like your role when you're working with different people?
I think it varies hugely, actually. Like every different rider I've worked for has been totally different, and it depends on a number of factors, like their personality, if you know them before you started sort of working with them, and their sort of experience with the circuit as well. Because I started working with Laurie Greenland when he joined the team for Dark World Racing, and it was like, I loved working with Laurie. He was absolutely brilliant to work with, and from day one it was brilliant because he was just so stoked to be on a team. And I'd be like, you know, okay, Laurie, like, how's that run? Do you want to like change your suspension, or like, do you want to do whatever? And he'd be like, yeah. He's like, I just can't believe I got this bike for free and I'm getting to ride this track today, you know. And I just be like, okay, yeah, that's good, but like, you need to give me a bit more sort of input here. He's like, nah, it's great, everything feels great.
So you get, awesome,
you get riders like that. And I'm sure Laurie's more, well, I know Laurie's more kind of into his setup now, like, as everybody is as they go on in their careers. But yeah, it varies from rider to rider, but it's probably, I guess it's one of our skill set as a World Cup mechanic to be able to figure that out sooner rather than later. And I think it is, as a rule, it's probably good to try and not work with people that you were friends with before. And okay, that was kind of that. It's not a hard and fast rule. There's loads of riders and mechanics who do that. But like Greg and I, for example, we had some good years together and some good races, but we came from a really like fun friendship. And as soon as it started to get serious and he had to tell me something that was uncomfortable, or I had to tell him to stop, you know, like worrying about something they shouldn't worry about, it was harder than it should be. So
yeah, that makes sense for sure.
Yeah.
So obviously being able to kind of morph and work in different ways with different people is a good asset. What else do you think makes a good mechanic?
Well, for a World Cup mechanic anyway, it's a real kind of all-around skill set that you need to have. You know, it's funny because people think that World Cup mechanics are the best mechanics ever, you know, like there's no better guys working in bike shops, but I honestly think there's loads of people all over the place that would be as good or better than World Cup mechanics at the actual mechanicking part of the job. But it's the fact that we have to do our job to the same level, whether we're having the best weekend ever and it's super chill and warm and nice and you're feeling great, or if you're you know, in a field under an easy up and the weather is horrible, and every time a bike comes down, it's like caked in mud. So it's, if you were a person that, and I've seen it in mechanics in the past, you know, if you were a person that is grumpy or gets agitated easily, it just wouldn't work, because you can never, we can never transfer our feelings onto the riders, because at the end of the day, like, they're the reason that we're there. They're the reason that the team's there, that, you know, we have this job. So it's all about kind of being in these really stressful situations, but acting like you're not stressed at all, which is kind of hard sometimes. But and sometimes you do lose it a little bit. But on the whole, I guess one of the skills that most World Cup mechanics have is being able to, like, kind of temper those feelings. And yeah, then apart from that, it's like, I don't know, being able to travel around and be in different cultures and different time zones, and, you know, not letting things like jet lag bother you as much as they might if you were on holiday, or you were more easily bothered by that stuff. And just, you know, to, like, work really well in less than ideal situations.
Yeah, I remember seeing a few of the team videos with, you know, floods coming into the pits and all sorts of stuff going on. So yeah, you guys don't always get an easy run of it, do you?
No. And I mean, it's, nobody ever gives me any sympathy when I complain about my job, but it can be, like, you know, it's long days, and, you know, we're usually working in slightly less than ideal situations, even though we do have a really dialed setup at YT Mob. But yeah, you know, it's just, if you love it, then you just make that stuff into a challenge and enjoy it and use it to kind of, like, work on your quick thinking and all that sort of thing. So yeah, I love it.
Yeah, cool, good stuff. Nice one. I want to talk a little bit about bike setup. So I read an interview with you recently where you said that you thought suspension setup and tire pressure are kind of the two most critical things for people to get right on their bikes, and I fully agree with that. Have you got any advice on how people could go about getting that stuff set up? Are there any, like, hard and fast rules that are easy to follow?
Yeah, well, I mean, probably the best thing to do is, if you have, like, a good suspension tuner near you, most of them will offer services where they can come and help you set your suspension up. That's definitely the best way to do it, because it can be a minefield, like, to make sense of all those settings. And the other thing that's annoying or makes suspension more difficult to set up is that no settings are really truly independent of each other. So when you adjust one thing, it always has an effect on something else. So if you're not taking that into account, you're not really going to get anywhere very fast. But you know, just I usually start with the rear suspension, because you can more accurately set the sag with the rear suspension, because you don't have the sort of bind in the fork that is generated from the head angle. Uh-huh. So it's a lot easier to accurately sort of set the sag on the rear. And then I never personally really set the sag on my front fork. I just kind of, as a very basic start, you can use the O-ring to kind of show that you're using about a third of the travel or whatever. And then it's a case of sort of with your damping in the middle or where you've got it to already and you're happy with it, then you can start working on the sort of front spring pressure, basically, by
right.
And I would usually just do that by kind of riding. And I think I wouldn't be a very good teacher of this, because I feel like I just know what is the right amount of how, like, stiff my fork should be, basically. But yeah, definitely.
Yeah, it is a tricky one, isn't it? It's a bit of a black box for a lot of people. I think if you don't know kind of what you're looking to feel or what you're looking for, then it's pretty hard to explain it to someone.
Yeah, and you know, the suspension's getting more and more settings on it all the time. And I just think of some of these four-way adjustable shocks and four-way adjustable forks, like, you know, if you don't have a good knowledge of what all those settings do, then it's going to be really difficult to get that stuff tuned in. And something that worked for me, and this is absolutely because of the way my mind works, but it might work for some people, is that I always try to figure out the technology inside the shock and fork and actually figure out what it's doing. Because it's always, I remember when I was learning a drive and learning how to use a clutch, as soon as I looked at a drawing like of what a clutch did, it made absolute sense to me and I could use it from then on. Yeah. So I find, like, with some of the suspension stuff, if you actually look at what's happening when you make adjustments, it made it a lot easier for me to figure out how that was going to actually affect how it rode. That might just be me, but for some people it might work.
I can buy into that, but then we've probably both got engineers' brains. Yeah. So maybe that's what it is. But yeah, I'm quite visual with stuff, so that helps me for sure.
Yeah. But I listened to Jordy's podcast, and he kind of talked about how he goes about setting up suspension, and that was really good.
Very true. I'll pop a link actually in the show notes for this episode, and people can head back to that. I think it was like episode 3 or something. It's a while ago, but yeah, I'll dig that out for people.
Yeah.
What about tire pressure? Are you how do you approach that one?
I'd say that's a bit easier to do. It depends on a number of things. Like, for example, here in Whistler where we ride, you ride the trail bike riding in the valley, like not the bike park. It's really low speed. Like the average speeds that you're hitting are really low for most of the trails compared to a lot of other places, like even Scotland where I'm from. Like the riding there is a lot higher speed. So that's a pretty good indicator off the bat that you're going to be wanting to run a slightly lower tire pressure, because you're less likely to be hitting objects fast and sort of really loading your bike into berms and things where you're going to get into situations where you're going to tear your tires off or burp them.
Yeah.
So usually kind of like have a think about where you're going to be riding mostly, and then start at somewhere probably where you've been before, you know, like somewhere 25 front and 30 in the rear, for example. And then I would try just lowering it maybe by 2 PSI each time and keep riding, go for another ride. And you're going to know when it's too low, like anybody, even a experienced rider, because you're going to keep hitting the rims, which is bad because you'll just puncture eventually. And also you'll get that horrible feeling where you go into a fast corner and you feel your tire fold or burp. So that would be a good indication that you've gone too low. And from there you could go up. And so as a basic rule for like technical mountain bike riding, I'd say you kind of want them as low as they can be without you hitting the rims excessively or feeling them fold a lot. Like, you know, on a trail up here, it could probably, I run like quite high pressures just because I always have, and I'm a bit stubborn about lowering them. But yeah, I can usually feel my rear tire fold once or twice in a ride. And that's, you know, kind of for me, I'm like, yeah, I'm pretty happy with this. So yeah. And then the other thing about it is just consistency. So even if it is slightly too high or slightly too low what you're running, if you get a good digital gauge and just check it before every ride, it'll make a huge difference, because the tires do go down pretty quickly, like tubeless ones. If you don't ride your bike for a week, they'll almost definitely a couple of PSI lower by the time you go back to them. So it's pretty important to keep on top of it.
Yeah. What's your go-to digital gauge?
I use I've used the SKS one and the Topeak one, and I like both.
Okay.
The Topeak one, you can use a Schrader valve on it as well, and I use that for my trials bike, so I've got that one now.
Awesome. All right, cool. And you're riding a Geometron, yeah?
Yeah.
How are you getting on with it?
Yeah, I love it. I had a bike which was it was a really good descending bike. I really liked the way it rode, and it looked cool, and it had everything going for it. But when I joined Cromag, when I started working there, went for a staff weekend riding trip, and I borrowed one of the Surface titanium hardtails. And I just couldn't get over how well it climbed, and I knew it was partly to do with the, you know, better power transfer on smooth ground on the hardtail, but I thought there must be more to it. So at this point, I'd kind of like been thinking about geometry quite a lot, but wasn't anywhere near as far down the rabbit hole as I am now. But yeah, I just looked into it, and it kind of seemed like it was a lot to do with the seat angle. It made total sense that if your weight was in a better position over the bottom bracket, that you were going to feel more comfortable climbing. And so I looked out a bike that kind of had the right numbers, and I'd actually seen the Geometrons for a couple of years and kind of thought, man, that seems pretty crazy. And, you know, a lot of people when they first came out were saying that they were ridiculous and kind of a bit too wacky, and I'd kind of like subconsciously listened to those people a little bit and kind of written them off. And when I actually looked at the numbers and thought, man, this could be really, really good. And so I ordered one, and I got it and built it up, and I rode it. And it's funny because the descending like took a couple of rides to get used to. It didn't feel instantly like mind blowing, and if anything, it felt a bit kind of cumbersome. And the bike that I'd had before was a really good like bike to manual and jump, and this one didn't do those quite as well, the Geometron.
Yeah.
But the thing that blew my mind straight away was the climbing, because it reminded me of riding a good cross-country bike back in the day. Like, I couldn't believe how well the rear wheel gripped the ground. It was like a combination of the steep sea angle and the long rear end, which you think would reduce grip on the rear wheel because it's sort of further away from your center of gravity, but it actually moves your weight kind of over the front, so it keeps the front wheel down, which keeps the bike nicely balanced. And then with the steep seat angle, you're sitting in the correct place. And there's climbs that I know really well here that I always slip out on a certain bit or something like that. And on this bike, I just sat there like a gear higher than I ever had and just pedaled up to the top. And I was like, what the hell? What's going on? This is insane. And then once I got used to the descending, which only took a couple of rides, it was just, yeah, brilliant. Like, you learn how to manual it. Like, it doesn't manual. It's harder to lift the front wheel up than a shorter bike. But
yeah,
it's just, if you can manual, it's just a case of learning where that new balance point is, and then you can do it. So that's not really an issue. And but the increase in stability and just poise of the bike, like, you feel you don't have to move your weight around as much, and your wheels are nicely weighted, and yeah, it's really good. Like, I read a lot of what Chris Porter has written, and I sort of admire his ideas on things, and he's done a lot for, if you look at all new bikes coming out now, they all have geometry that arguably has been influenced by these bikes that, you know, Geometron and a few others started. But he often talks about how, you know, going fast is more fun than manualing and, you know, jumping. And I guess that's true for him, but I do actually like, I really like pulling little manuals on the trail or doing jumps and stuff. And so I think it's important, but I also think you can learn it on any bike.
Yeah. Yeah. And how have you had to adjust your riding style to get the most out of it? Have you found like certain things that you've had to change, or is it just a case of getting used to it?
I feel like I've had to become more calm on the bike. Like, you don't have to put as much kind of body language into it, if that makes sense. You kind of just you look at where you're going to go. You look further ahead than you ever did before because you're usually going faster. And yeah, you kind of like just go for it. And I feel like you don't have to throw your weight around to get it to respond. And it's crazy because we have a lot of rock rolls here out in Whistler, and they're just like really kind of like skate park rolling, you know, a lot of rocks like that. And at the bottom, they've often got really big compressions when it goes back out to the normal trail. And
yeah,
those are usually the place where you're going to have a bad time on a rock roll. You're going to, like, if it's too big of a compression, you're going to hit the handlebars or your chest and have a bad time in general. And on the Geometron, it's just, it made so many rock rolls that I used to kind of think of as decent or like something to consider on this trail, like you just ride down them and you get to the bottom and you're like, oh, that's easy.
And amazing.
I absolutely agree with Chris that you know, people often say to me when they're kind of saying why they don't want to get a bike like that with sort of kind of what is now thought of as extreme or more normal geometry now, but is that they don't want to lose, you know, they're like, oh, I just like popping off things and manuals and blah, blah, blah. And, but going faster than you've ever done, faster than you've ever gone before is really fun. And that's what I've realized. So anything that awesome. Lost in that real like poppiness and playful feel has been replaced and surpassed by sort of going faster.
Cool. A happy customer. Yeah. And you're running 29 front wheel, 27.5 rear wheel.
Yeah. I'm kind of always playing around with different wheel setups. So it started as a 29er front and rear. And then Nico and I were chatting a lot when it looked like 29er downhill bikes were going to become a thing, which we were both really behind because Nico loves 29ers and I do too.
Yeah.
We were just talking consistently about bike setup and geometry and how we could make it kind of as good as possible. And we kept discussing this idea of having a smaller back wheel because it seemed like you could really get a lot of the advantages, most of the advantages of the 29er wheels by just having a front one. But then by putting a smaller rear wheel on, you would get sort of maybe quicker turning, you know, better braking on that wheel and a few other kind of advantages. And so he's been testing it on a downhill bike and I've just been playing around with it on mine. And I've ended up with this 27 plus tire on the back, which I never ever thought I would use or endorse, but it's pretty good. Like I'd like it to be a bit heavier so it didn't have as flimsy sidewalls, but it's kind of like a cool setup because I was inspired by, like, I've been riding I've got a gas trials bike and been trying to go out on that quite a lot, and it's got a super wide low pressure rear tire and then just this skinny front tire, you know, and like you're not descending on it, so it's a totally different application, but the way those bikes climb is insane. So I was like, if I can get this bike to climb even better with this like lower pressure wide rear high volume rear tire but still get like snappy corner in and the kind of front wheel feel that I want 29er, then I should try it. I did, and I've ridden it probably 5 times like that, and I really like it so far.
Awesome. Do you think we'll see a mixture of wheel sizes at World Cup this year? Because it's now allowed in the UCI legislation, I think.
Yeah, I'm not too sure. I think probably I'd probably hedge my bets and say no. Like you might get one or two smaller teams or smaller bike brands doing it, but a decision as big as that, like wheel size, is going to be dictated by the manufacturer, I think. And even if a rider had tested it in their own time and thought it was brilliant, they'd have a hard time convincing a manufacturer to let them do that, I think, because you know they are thinking about selling bikes, and I can't see a big manufacturer selling a downhill bike with different size wheels for a while. Maybe I'm totally wrong, but and also chatting to Nico a lot about it, he's done a lot of time testing with it. And he found that he basically slightly preferred the feel of the 27-29, but I think the 29er timed runs were faster, just very slightly. So I think because he didn't think the feel was significantly better, that he was going to stay on 29-29. And, you know, that's for most racers, that's what it comes down to, is either how fast it can go. And yeah, I do notice when I go from the 29-29 to the 27-29, you feel the back wheel. I feel like I can feel it hooking up on things more, like, you know, every little bump that I'm hitting, the front wheel glances over it, and the rear wheel, it kind of like feels like it pulls my body back. And maybe that's, you know, that's my confirmation bias thinking that it's going to do that. But
yeah, maybe.
Yeah, I don't
know. Interesting stuff, though.
Yeah. I think it's just really good to test all these things. And bicycles are about the only two-wheeled sort of vehicle around that has the same size wheels. So there's probably something in that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So what do you think we'll see in the next few years then? Where do you think bike technology is headed? Have you got any thoughts on what sort of things might become more prevalent?
Yeah, well, I mean, people always, I guess, talk about electronics. It's going to happen at some point. I don't know to what level, but if there could be a electronic damping control that was really good and really compact, then I could see that becoming a thing, because I've seen the trend over the last few years. I think it's partly to do with two things, to do with the tracks getting a bit, in some cases, a bit more mellow. Like they're not really, some of them are still super gnarly, most of them are still super gnarly, but they're getting like some more open sections and pedally sections. So riders have started talking more about lockouts over the last couple of years, in my experience.
Yeah.
And it's maybe to do as well with just the general level increasing and guys looking for fractions of a second everywhere they can. So, you know, we have had lockouts on bikes at various times over the years, but they've always been a bit kind of clunky and not ideal. And I think, I can't remember which race it was, but Aaron locked his shock out somewhere and rode like most of the track with it locked out by mistake. I think it was Cairns. So, you know, I don't think it's too much for a rider to think about when they're racing. So anyway, if we could have like an electronic system to control that, which is really sleek and actually worked, see that happening. But I think probably one of the main things is geometry. Not to harp on about it too much, but I think what we're seeing in downhill bikes now is what we saw in trail bikes when they first went to 29er, and the first kind of wave of 29er trail bikes sucked. Like, they were terrible. And it's because they basically made 29er wheels fit in a 27 bike and didn't really change anything else. And it's only after, what, like 10 years of 29er trail bikes being a common thing that we're starting to kind of like get to the right place with them now. So I think the geometry has got a long way to go.
Okay, even on the downhill side of things, and you think there's still room to improve the 29er downhill bike geometries?
Yeah, definitely. If we're only, you know, this is year, there's probably going to be year two or three of there being like a significant number of 29er downhill bikes, and a lot of them being carbon fiber nowadays, you know, you can't change them very quickly. And so, yeah, I think we still got a few more years of some pretty big changes. And also now with fork offset becoming more of like a prevalent thing that people think about, I think that will start to affect the geometry, because you can change the fork offset and get some advantages that mean you can then regain some advantages that you might have lost by, like, say, slacking out the head angle too much, for example. So I don't know, it's such a minefield, geometry, and the way that bike is a system, and how the everything, handlebar width and sweep and roll and stem length, offset, head angle, like, it's like I'm not going to say it's an art, because I kind of hate it when people say stuff like that's an art, but it's like there's so many inputs there that there's no one that's figured it out 100%, and if anyone says they have, they're wrong.
Yeah, there's a ton of interactions going on, isn't there? We've puzzled over that quite a lot in a little group of mates, and you can feel changes when you change stuff, but as far as being able to optimize that system, I have no idea.
Yeah, and I think that's brilliant. It's good.
Yeah, it's nice that we've still got things we don't understand, right?
Yeah, and it's cool, and it's nice to think of, like, you know, bikes nowadays look amazing and incredible, the technology that goes into them, and I can never get my head around the fact that in 10 years they're going to look old and laughable.
Yeah, it seems crazy, doesn't it? But you don't have to go back even that many years, really, to look at downhill bikes, and they look pretty odd now.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, cool. All right, good stuff. So we're getting towards the end of our time, but we've got our usual three questions that we end up with. But before that, I'm kind of interested to hear your pick for men's overall and a women's overall downhill World Cup 2019 winner.
Whoa.
If you had to put money, where would it go? Because it's a pretty tricky one these days. There's so many people that could take both titles, really.
Yeah, it's really hard. I would say for men, I'm going to say Lucas Shaw.
Yeah, feels like it's his time.
Yeah, and he's an awesome dude, and I really like him. So it would be nice if he did. And I don't know, he's just had some bad race runs and stuff, which is just part of it. So at some point, he'll have some, you know, better race runs. And I think when he does and he strings them together, he's definitely got the potential to do it.
Yeah,
and I think for women, Tani, it's Tani's time. And
what makes you think this is her year?
I don't know. I mean, this is like, you can never count Rachel out because she's just an awesome athlete and an awesome rider. So I think there's also a big chance that she'll do well. But Tani's, like, you know, been on the same program for a long time and just been incrementally and consistently getting better every year. And so I could totally see her do it.
Yeah. I guess obviously a big program change for Rachel, so new bikes and things to learn. So
that, you know, sometimes that works out really well, and sometimes it doesn't. And I guess we won't know.
Yeah. All right. Good stuff. Well, we hit our three questions. So first of those is, and I think I've done this conversion right, if people had $250, which is about £150, for people to improve their performance on a bike, what would you recommend they go spend it on?
Not super cliche, but I would say coaching. Find a good coach, like a lot of ex-pro riders do it now. And even if they're not ex-pro riders, you can get people who are really good coaches. And I get some like cornering tips and just how to ride your bike better, because everybody at every level can benefit from that. And, you know, it's sometimes hard to get the courage to ask for some coaching when you've been riding all your life or whatever. But, you know, a few of my friends work as bike park instructors here in Whistler, and one of them taught me how to corner like 2 years ago. He told me, like, this is what you're actually meant to be doing. And I can't remember what it was, the actual exact tip he gave me, but I just thought about it and started doing it. And I was like, night and day difference. And I've been riding my whole entire life. So I was like, that's, you know, that's worth a lot more than a Chris King headset.
yeah, definitely. All right. And then if you could wind the clock back and have a chat with yourself, age 16, what advice would you give him?
I would say try not to worry about jobs in the future and try not to worry about getting in exactly the right position that you want to be in job wise, because you kind of just have to go with the flow and do the jobs that, you know, present themselves to you that you've tried to kind of apply for and everything. And if you do enough of those and you have the right kind of end goal, things will usually fall into place, like in the right kind of direction.
Yeah, don't stress about it.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, cool. And then the final question, if you could have some coaching with anyone, any rider past or present, who would it be and what would you want to learn from them? And you've probably already had the opportunity to ride with some pretty good people.
Yeah, I think the best guy, it's a bit of a bad answer because I've already ridden with this guy, but the best person I've ever ridden with is Brooke McDonald, because people get, you know, he has this reputation as being the bulldog, and that might make you think that he's a bit of a kind of hack, you know, but he's the absolute opposite. He's got so much finesse and like grace bike. And we rode a lot in Chamonix a couple of years ago, and the main takeaway from riding with him was, like, I would always puzzle over these little routes or sections or, you know, just features on the trail, and Brooke just jumps them all So I'm like, oh, okay, that makes it so much easier. It's like, don't even try and figure out how to like pick your nice line through these roots. Just like look at the first root that's going to give you enough air to clear the whole thing and do it.
Fair play. Spend as much time off the ground as possible.
Yeah, pretty much. So yeah, it'd probably be like a, you know, that was never proper coaching session. So I'd probably have like a actual one-on-one with Brooke where he was actually concentrating on my riding.
Cool. That's a unique answer. We've not had that one yet.
Yeah. Good.
Wicked. All right, cool. Well, it's been super interesting sitting down and chatting. I'm excited to see how the 2019 season goes for you at the Mob. And yeah, all the best.
Awesome. Thanks a lot, Chris.
Nice one. Cheers, Ben.
Cheers.
Well, that's it for this week's episode. I hope you've enjoyed listening. A massive thank you to 661 and the Trailhead Bicycle Company for supporting this episode. Head to 661.com and check out their new Reset MIPS helmet, the perfect full face for anyone who doesn't want to spend a fortune but still wants to be safe. And as a listener, you get 25% off using the code DOWNTIMEPODCAST25. And don't forget to show your local bike shop some love. And if you're in Shropshire, then visit the Trailhead and mention this podcast for your free top cap or fender. Don't forget to give us a follow on social media. Just search for @DOWNTIMEPODCAST. Get subscribing to make your life easier and get each episode delivered to your device as soon as it's available. If you want to support what we're doing, then you can visit our webshop at downtimepodcast.com/shop, where we've got t-shirts, hoodies, sweats and mugs. But most of all, please keep telling your friends about this podcast. I know that loads of you have been spreading the word. I want to say a massive thanks for that. It means a lot to me and it really is how people find us and how this spreads. All right, we've got another episode coming up real soon. But until then, get out and ride.